uprisingview.com, a free speech website that promotes pretty much any apolitical view. We just want good stories. We publish stories that are not necessarily going to be published by other people, sometimes for political reasons. You know, as you may have found out, if you're a writer, not everybody wants to publish things that are controversial, and that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today, about the ethos of Uprising Review and about some of the anecdotes that we have had in our lives, you know, from our family, from our friends, from people wanting to know about the free speech ethos in writing. And so I'm going to kind of start this off with something you may have noticed if you've been to our website, or at least were in the last month or so. We published an op-ed that I wrote that essentially was defending a neo-Nazi, and or at least his right to speak without being sued. And I'll give a little bit of a background on that. There is a website called DailyStormer.com run by a guy named Andrew Anglin. And Andrew is being sued by the Southern Poverty Law Center and a woman from Montana claiming that he and his minions have been harassing her. And they probably have. They kind of get into Discord wars with other people, from what I understand. But, you know, that's something that it didn't sit well with me whenever I found out about it, that this website that is essentially, you know, has many views that I don't agree with, will be possibly shut down because people with a lot of money are suing them. And that's something that doesn't sit well with me. And so I wrote an op-ed about it, and you can read that on our website. And, you know, that is something that is controversial, of course, because when you're defending free speech, you have to ask the question, is it free speech if it's not free speech for everybody? And that's something Stephen wanted to talk about, and that's something I want to talk about. So, Stephen, this was your topic. Hit us when you're ready.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, back when we were starting the Uprising Review, I think it was before we published anything, we were just taking submissions. You know, I was talking to somebody about it, and, you know, said, hey, you know, I've got this thing, the Uprising Review, it's, you know, a literary magazine promoting free speech and just allowing, you know, not wanting to censor people just because they, you know, thought a different way from us, or they wrote a style that we, you know, maybe didn't agree with. It was just, you know, we just want good writing. And, you know, they had a very, you know, unusual reaction, in my view. You know, they weren't really sure about that. They weren't sure if they really liked that idea. And it shocked me because, you know, I had never had that experience where somebody, you know, you say free speech and automatically they think, oh, you know, you're going to allow, you know, something morally reprehensible on your site or something like that. And my first reaction was, well, not really. I mean, I don't think we would end up, you know, getting something and publishing something that was completely out there, you know, like a defending Nazis or something like that.
Although we kind of did.
You know, their belief system is what,
yeah,
I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Other hand, thinking about that, though, on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, you know, what if somebody were to write a story about that? Maybe that's something that we should try to understand, you know, not necessarily in a sympathetic sense, but more of, you know, let's try to understand that kind of evil, kind of thing. And someone else probably wouldn't publish that. I think if for fiction, a lot of fiction that maybe some would consider to be morally reprehensible, you know, isn't necessarily something that the writer agrees with, but is more often than not something that, you know, the writer just wants to explore, kind of thing.
Yeah, and I know we kick this around a lot, or at least that this book around a lot, but it is such an influential book. It's one of the great American novels. It's Lolita, and I don't think for a second that Vladimir Nabokov was channeling his own views whenever he was having Humbert seduce a 12-year-old girl. I just don't think that he was.
No, I mean, I think that's very clear.
Yeah,
absolutely. It.
It's a novel about the American road is what it's a novel about. But it uses this very taboo subject to to explore that. And, you know, I don't know that a book like that would get published today. And in fact, there's actually an interesting book called Reading Lolita in Tehran, which if you haven't read that is a very good book as well. I forget the name of the author, but it's kind of the exploration of the free speech ethos when you live in a very repressive culture.
Yeah, and I was just looking up a comment that was left by one of the guys who wrote the story The Mirage on the Uprising Review. Yeah.
David Whitaker.
He left a comment, I think it was on, I'm looking up right now actually. Yeah, it was on our first podcast, and we were of course talking about, you know, free speech and writing, just kind of introducing the Uprising Review. And he said, you know, writing should be about starting a conversation and considering new ideas. And it shouldn't matter if readers don't agree with the story. And in quotations, maybe the author doesn't either. And, you know, that can often be part of the fun. And, you know, it's not, and, you know, we just wanted the Uprising Review to be a place where you can explore different ideas and to step over the line a little bit and say, you know, let's see what this type of person believes, or write a character that is completely out there that I don't agree with in any way, but I just want to explore, you know, the way that they think or the way that they act.
Yeah, and you know, that's something that I try as the author of historical fiction and science fiction to a lesser degree, is I find myself exploring characters, not necessarily in a moral way, but exploring characters that I can't possibly understand. I mean, whenever I was writing my story about medieval Japan, I was trying to think about Japanese honor. And that's just, first of all, it's a little different than Western honor, the kind of honor that you would find in Italy or Greece. And it's different than 20th and 21st century honor. And it's different than, you know, pagan honor, where they believed that your honor hung around outside your grave and passed on to your children. It was not simply a good reputation. And so I had to think about this in a way that was really different to me. And when I was thinking about the samurai honor, I ran across something that frankly weirded me the hell out. And I don't know if I've ever talked about this or not before, but I chose to exclude it from my book simply because I didn't want it in there. But what I discovered is that there were many pedophilic relationships among samurai. A samurai would oftentimes have a kind of a young lover. And this is something that you see in Japanese literature sometimes, oftentimes along with suicide. I read this book called Five Women Who Love Love, and it was a series of short stories, but one of the stories in it, if I'm remembering this correctly, was about a woman who was upset that her husband was in love with the little boy next door. And I found out, oh God, this is like pretty common in samurai literature, like of the time. And my question was, do I want this in my novel? And I guess I kind of chickened out and said, no, I don't, because I didn't write it in. When I wanted to write my novel, I wanted it to be beautiful and heroic and epic. And I didn't really want to deal with things that are, you know, necessarily morally disgusting to me. So that is something that maybe I should have done in hindsight. But I was a younger person when I wrote that, and I was a different person when I wrote that. And you know, I think that kind of self-censorship isn't really good, is it? Maybe that's the worst form of censorship.
I think there's merit to going both ways with that. On one hand, yeah, you can just have a great heroic story, but, you know, if you wanted to explore, you know, that aspect of it as well, you know, I see it kind of both ways. But the one thing that I think we're seeing now is, you know, through publishers and through critics and people, you know, currently who are, I guess, kind of sort of trying to control the, probably not just in writing, but, you know, in just creativity in general, is they're trying to encourage self-censorship. And that's the sort of censorship today that we're seeing. You know, it's not coming from, you know, governments like it was, you know, maybe in...
Yeah, like whenever the government banned Ulysses.
Yeah, we don't see that coming from industries today.
Yeah, so I guess we could say there are two major types of censorship today. There is the corporate censorship, where, you know, what are there five or six major publishers and many, many subsidiaries of each of those? And if somebody doesn't like what you write, you're really not going to get it published anywhere because they're all very incestuous and everybody knows everybody and they have the same politics and they have the same beliefs and they have the same agendas. They want to publish the same kind of books. So that is a kind of censorship. But, you know, that does, I think, lead to self-censorship when you are thinking about writing. Because that's what happened to me, and I'm trying not to do that in this upcoming book. I don't want to censor my views of Renaissance Italy, or their differences in morality and standards and the way they view things. That's me maturing a little bit, I think. But yeah, that is really the case. And that's something I think Uprising Review does pretty well. You know, I was talking to John De La Rose yesterday or the day before, something like that. And he was talking about his experience essentially getting kicked out of Bacon for his political beliefs. And, you know, I don't want to turn this into a political diatribe here. I don't think that's the purpose of this podcast. But there are many people who are center-right or right-wing or far-right who don't feel as if they're going to get their ideas out through mainstream publishing. And so maybe that's one of the points of Uprising Review, is that we can publish things that are, well, not necessarily popular among the literati.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I was so amazed because, you know, as somebody who kind of leans right, for years, I mean, we see it all over the place, you know, the sort of, censorship of those ideas. But I was so amazed at just how many people on the left are also being censored simply because they don't subscribe to a particular way of doing things or a particular way of conveying an idea in stories or on you know, racial or gender grounds or whatever it is. It's really a shame.
Yeah, and we talked about my friend who is a kind of a center-left person who I got his, and I'm trying to get him to write an op-ed for us, who got his book essentially taken away from him because of, you know, political reasons. I mean, the first book didn't have enough diversity. The second book was accused of cultural appropriation. You know, that is a kind of censorship. And this is the way I view sort of the left and the center left today is I view them as a little nightclub with leftists in them. And what they've done is they've let the insane social justice warriors act as bouncers. And they're going around the bar kicking out everybody who says a naughty word or who misgenders someone or who offends someone else's opinion. And, you know, yeah, I think that's right that we do see, you know, good left-wing people who maybe just disagree over healthcare or something or disagree over, you know, transgender bathrooms. Maybe, you know, they're being driven out of left-wing politics and they're being driven out of the mainstream as well. And maybe that's, you know, Uprising Review is apolitical and we certainly will publish their work as well if they submit it to us. But, you know, that I think is the purpose of having a free speech magazine like Uprising Review.
Yeah. And I've even seen, you know, figures like Bill Maher complain about things very similar to that, where he's just seeing the sort of corrosion just the things that, you know, the SJW type people are doing. I'm just being frustrated by it. And he's certainly not the only one I've heard just on the left saying that.
Yeah, there are plenty of comedians like Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld and things that say, you know what, I just don't play college campuses because of the crowds. I mean, these crowds are insane. They won't laugh at anything you say, and you can't say anything that offends them. And that is unfortunate because, you know, the stand-up comedian is in a way a kind of a stand-up philosopher, and in the same way that a writer is kind of a philosopher as well. You have to be able to express these ideas, whether they're left-wing or right-wing, and you have to be able to express ideas you don't necessarily agree with. I mean, whenever I write a short story, like in science fiction, as I did for my science fiction collection, some of the views I put forward are not views I agree with. You know, they're sort of, you know, very globalist, I guess you could call it, very anti-identitarian views, that I just don't agree with, but that's something I wanted to express. And had I put that into a major publisher, or had I tried to go through, Tor or something, it would never have been published. And all of these short stories that have ended up in my collection, I did try to submit them to major short story publishers, and they were all rejected. So yeah, that's something that I've dealt with. It's something I think we all deal with.
Yeah, and I am pretty, I don't like to say I'm religious, but it wouldn't be inaccurate.
You're a church-going boy.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't see it as like a religious type of thing, but I'm definitely...
Yeah,
I mean,
you go to church and you sing in the choir.
Leader in my church, yeah. I don't think I've ever really written them. I'm thinking about it right now. Trying to think back. I don't think I've ever really written a religious type of character. And in fact, I think a lot of my characters are more kind of amoral or more, leaning towards the other side.
Flannery O'Connor-esque, I guess, where Flannery was a very devout Catholic who wrote about serial killers in the 1950s.
Yeah, no, that's a really great example. Like, I don't really find I enjoy writing more kind of religious people with strict moral compasses. I don't know. I find it more interesting to write about people I absolutely find repulsive and don't agree with.
Yeah.
But that doesn't reflect who I am. I mean, it's kind of me exploring different ideas or more or less amusing myself. I mean, if I'm not going to do that, but what's the point of doing it?
Yeah.
Which kind of brings me to something else I was thinking about. A while back, I was driving my grandma to a doctor's appointment or something, and she was talking about this book that she had been reading, and how the there were so many swear words in it or whatever it was. And so I was like, well, who's swearing? Is the writer swearing, or is the character swearing? Because that's a huge difference. Because if I'm going to write about a gangbanger from Harlem, there's going to be some swearing there. I'm not going to write. He's not going to say, "Oh, jeepers! I'm going to that's just stupid." It's very unauthentic. In fact, I think anyone saying jeepers,
yeah,
just comes across very wrong.
Yeah, that would. But this actually brings, I have similar stories. My grandmother, before she passed away, was a very big reader and always encouraged me to write. And that's one of the things that, keeps me going, is that she, before she passed away, made me promise to keep writing, because she really did like my writing, even though I'm not getting rich off of it or anything. But that is something that, she and I talked about, was she doesn't like violence, and she doesn't really like blood and gore, and she doesn't like a lot of sex in novels. And that's, that's something that I think, Maybe it's a function of age, but I've had that similar experience as well. Is if I write sex into a novel, and is it me that's doing it? I mean, it's obviously me that's writing it, but is it something I agree with? Is it something I want? I mean, is it something that the woman who wrote 50 Shades of Grey necessarily sits around thinking about bondage with billionaires?
Well, there might be an exception there.
That probably is. given the prevalence of bondage porn on Reddit.
No, but I mean, like, Lolita. I mean, we pretty much... I mean, it's very obvious, and I know we said this earlier, but it's very obvious through reading it. I mean, I think he purposely made it very obvious that, he doesn't... He's not into 12-year-old girls.
Yeah.
Nabokov, but... In so many other arenas, I don't really think he's kind of he's often thought of in that light. But in many other arenas, like, we too often see writing and just assume, oh, the writer agrees with this or thinks this way. Many times we need to realize that it's okay for a writer to explore a controversial topic or a taboo scenario.
Yeah, or like Hemingway. Yeah. I mean, Hemingway is often accused of anti-Semitism and sexism and misogyny by modern literary critics for things like The Sun Also Rises. I mean, The Sun Also Rises has some, kind of anti-Semitic tones to it. But that doesn't mean that Hemingway himself hated Jews. And that doesn't mean that he himself was, you know, necessarily a sexist. I mean, you could probably say, okay, well, he was a man of his time when it comes to writing the way women, or he viewed women. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that he's an anti-Semite or that he hates women. It just means that, you know, he's a man of his time. And I think that's something that we need to understand, too, when we're looking at books or movies or anything else, is that sometimes they come from a different time, and it's okay to have different values in different times. We don't have to be perfectly evolved men, where we have, you know, the most wonderful liberated view of woman as this, you know, sort of independent, strong, fierce woman who can be Wonder Woman or whatever.
So I guess, because I was even thinking, you know, can fiction even be, like, how far does a writer, how far can a writer go before it really is morally reprehensible? I mean, does the writer, I mean...
Okay, I would put it this way. There's a quote that I remember from someone, and I wish I could remember who said this, or I would attribute it. But it was someone writing about Dostoevsky, and Dostoevsky writes about deep moral issues. And this was a person who said that whenever she was, I think it was a woman, and she said that whenever she was younger, her parents had her reading things like Dostoevsky. And they sat her down and said, okay, we're going to read Crime and Punishment together. Now, this is a book about sin, but I don't want you to read it as an occasion for sin. And I think that that's probably the difference, that you can write a book that has morally objectionable things in it, but without making it an instance of morally objectionable values. You know, you can, as she said, read about sin or write about sin in a way that is not an occasion for sin.
Yeah, and you know, that even makes me think of a lot of the, you know, in high schools, you know, these a lot of religious groups will try, or elementary schools more often, religious groups will go in and try to get certain books banned, like Harry Potter, for instance. When, I don't know a kid who ever, I mean, the concerns are so trivial, like, you know, a kid won't understand that it's fiction, which is stupid. I mean, I mean, it's pretty obvious. You know, we all know, you know, even the kid.
Yeah. Are you talking about like religious groups? Child. Are you talking about like religious groups want it banned for magic or something?
Yeah. No, yeah. That's exactly what I'm talking about. Even a very young child understands, you know, magic doesn't exist. I mean, unless you've severely destroyed this child
yeah.
But you know, it's ridiculous to think that you know a book of fiction is going to be, you know, read by a child. I mean, especially one that's usually what's the age for Harry Potter? You know, 10 and up,
yeah, something
kind of thing. By that age, you really understand. Okay, this is magic. It doesn't exist. It's fiction, and we see it all over the place. So it's not.
It's not promoting magic. It just has magic.
Right. I mean, it's not like it's promoting, you know, Wiccan, you know, ideals. It's just, it's a fiction book.
Yeah.
And so it's really that same principle, that we can apply to other moral issues as well. And books that deal with much deeper topics, and say, okay, you know, it's a book of fiction that explores this sort of morally reprehensible topic.
Yeah, that actually kind of reminds me, I guess you're a little young for it, but there was a guy in the 90s named Jack Thompson who thought that video games would make people violent, and he believed that the school shootings in the 90s were the result of violent video games, and he went around trying to get them banned. He also tried to get a bunch of other rap banned and things like that. Maybe you've heard of him. I don't know. But, you know, his belief was that it's kind of like monkey see, monkey do. If we expose kids to violent video games, they will become violent. And that's the same mindset of people like Anita Sarkeesian, and you know, who's the nemesis of Gamergate, or one of the nemesis of Gamergate. She believed that sexist video games would make men sexist, or you know, that if there were unequal gender representations in Batman or something, that you would end up with these sexist viewpoints among men. And that's kind of So she created her feminist frequency to essentially criticize it. And there's a lot of videos of her on YouTube, and I'm not going to go into this, of her saying things like, you know, everything is racist, everything is sexist, everything is homophobic, and you have to call it out. And, you know, that is a kind of censorship that we really need to fight. Because, first of all, it's based on a flawed premise that we are incapable of controlling our own impulses based on what we've done. And second of all, I think it's really dangerous for artists and creators, and it's really annoying for people who enjoy the material. I don't have to see Batman's butt to enjoy the Batman video game and know that, you know, whatever. I mean, it's just, that kind of crap just annoys me. And I think that's what you're getting at as well. You know, the art has to be didactic. Art has to be moral. Art has to be something that you can instruct with. And I don't believe that at all. I believe that art can explore things that are dangerous and without hurting people.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and you know, I think that this sort of propensity to call these things out for being, you know, wrongly called them out for being sexist or, you know, whatever in most cases, is very unhealthy. And it perpetuates this idea that somehow free speech is automatically hateful. You know, that was such a shock to me, to get that reaction that you know, a literary magazine that promotes free speech automatically must absolutely, you know, promote, you know, hateful ideas. You know, I think a great example, very current example, Mein Kampf was recently republished in Germany, and it became, you know, I think it was the top selling book when that happened. I think it was just a few months ago or last year or something.
I didn't even think you could own Mein Kampf in Germany. I know you can't display swastikas.
No, I know. I think they recently just changed. We'll have to look it up.
Okay, yeah.
But it was recently republished, and it became the best-selling book. And that's not a testament to Hitler. I mean, I don't think anyone buying it is saying, oh, you know, I want to buy this book because I support his ideals. It's an exploration of those ideals of, you know, as I was saying earlier, of that type of evil, of, you know, of his accomplishments, for lack of sounding, I don't know,
Nazi-like,
supportive, yeah. of his accomplishments, which they were, to him.
Yeah, there's a similar thing going on kind of in the alt-right right now, and that is there's an author named Julius Evola. He is a kind of obscure early 20th century Italian philosopher who is largely considered to be the father of fascism. Odd, but he criticized Il Duce, Mussolini, and Hitler for not going far enough in fascism. But he wrote books like Revolt Against Modernity and Ride the Tiger, which have recently become kind of popular since the rise of the alt-right, and people are now talking about these books, and they're saying things about them. And I saw an article not long ago, I forgot which website it was on, it was like, you know, New York Daily Mag or something, I don't remember, that said, you know, Steve Bannon, Trump's top advisor, is a fan of fascist philosopher. And I was just thinking, you know, I've read Evola, and it didn't turn me into a fascist. It has a lot of ideas I like. I believe in traditionalism. I believe in traditional values. I think those things are things I agree with. But it does not make me want to start a fascist party. It's just, you know, it's kind of like if I read, God, I don't know. I can't think of a good analogy off the top of my head. It's like if I were to read a book about, you know, the Crusades, one of the pilgrim journals of the Crusades. There are many of them. It's not going to make me want to go walk the Holy Land, right? The fact is that we're adults. We can read, we can interpret, we can understand things, and it isn't going to make us behave in a certain way. I'll tell you a good example. A few years ago, there was a republication of, I think it was Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. Was it Tom Sawyer? But it took Nigger Jim and turned it into Black Jim, or something like that. Or just Jim. And that to me was kind of like, okay, so you're going to try to correct an author because it offends you and because you're worried that it is going to perpetuate racism in the 21st century. That's stupid.
It really is. I mean, I can't even imagine that being that, like, it would just seem weird reading that with like that.
Yeah, there's also a funny one that replaces Nigger Jim with Robot Jim.
But no, but things like that are a testament to the time period. They're a testament to how people thought, how people, you know, just how the scenario that Mark Twain wanted to portray, and in the time and place that they were written, and it's a shame that we feel that we need to change those things it's very.
Yeah, you know, part of the power of a novel.
In no way, go ahead.
I was going to say, part of the power of a novel, or any really work of art, is the fact that it reflects the people who created it, and it reflects their values, and it reflects who they were at that point in time and where they were. You know, Russian nationalist novels reflect the dusha, the Russian soul. You know, Renaissance art reflects the values of the Renaissance period, where they were attempting to portray in realistic ways the human body. That does not mean that they were promoting pornography by painting naked men or having a sculpture. You know, the sculpture of the David is naked. Michelangelo's David is naked. It does not mean that Michelangelo is promoting, you know, standing around yanking it in front of the statue.
No, and in much the same way, is it Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer?
I forget which one it is. I always get those two confused. Let's just call it Huckleberry Finn, because I think that's what it is. Tom Sawyer.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah, Tom Sawyer, I think, was the original one, because Huckleberry Finn opens with that phrase, "You don't know me, except by a novel called Tom Sawyer," or something like that.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. But no, Huckleberry Finn in no way promotes racism. In fact, I think it probably promotes the opposite.
Well, to be fair, I mean, it did have me with a net chasing black people down the street trying to get my crops pricked, but, you know. You knew it was coming.
Yeah. No, but it's I mean, to say that we have to change nigger to black or whatever, it's a very I don't find that healthy, and I think that encourages.
It's patronizing, isn't it? It's the notion that
very much.
It's the notion that someone knows better than you what you can read, and that pisses me off.
Yeah, and as a writer, you know, who's to say something that we write today won't 150 years from now be considered very offensive, inadvertently. And especially if it's another theme, if it's a, you know, a word or a phrasing, you know, somehow changing that, it becomes very patronizing, and it's then not a reflection of the thoughts and ideas during, you know, that time period.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, think in terms of something like, you know, it seems to me that the world is going to become more conservative. I view the world, you know, this younger generation is becoming more and more conservative, you know, relative to my generation and the baby boomers. It's like, you know, I see the world as a kind of a pendulum. As a historian, I see it as a pendulum that swings back and forth between these two various extremes. And I have seen throughout European history that there are times when, you know, sexuality is quite loose, and there are times when it is quite restricted. And I think that, you know, in 40 or 50 years, you know, a book like Venus and Furs, which is essentially masochism, or, you know, a book like, what was it that the Marquis de Sade wrote? I forget the name of his book. I think those would probably be maybe banned in some ways. And I think, you know, maybe Amistad Maupin's Tales of the City would also be banned. I mean, think of this. YouTube recently introduced this kind of a censorious method where they were trying to keep little kids from seeing adult messages. And some of the things that got flagged as adult messages were sort of like coming out videos that gay people were making. You know, that is not, you know, that is not the kind of thing that the censors planned. But it happened anyway. And right now, as we record this, the UK election is going on, and Theresa May, after the latest London terror attacks, promised to crack down on hate speech online. So, you know, I mean, we are moving in a more censorious direction. And you're right to point out that what we view as acceptable, maybe in the 90s or in the 2000s, in the 2040s is probably not going to be acceptable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and just, it's, in the next few years, what happens with censorship is going to be pretty interesting. I mean, in Germany, we're seeing a huge shift right now towards people, you know, really waking up and realizing, oh my gosh, like, we have to stop, you know, all of this censorship online, because it's, you know, it's, that's not what is perpetuating, terrorism and hate speech.
Yeah, it's like on Gab, both Steven and I are on Gab, it's kind of how we met. There's been a recent influx of Germans. There's like a lot of Germans on Gab for some reason.
A ton of Germans. I'm like, damn, I should have learned German instead of that.
Yeah, you should have. you should have. But, you know, that is, I think, a direct result of the fact that the German government under Angela Merkel will not allow adults to talk about the Islamification of Germany and the import of immigrants. You know, I have a friend who, you know, he lives in Germany. He won't tell me where. He won't tell me really anything about him, but I've known the guy for a long time. And he, from Gab, and he kind of goes through VPNs and uses Tor and just all kinds of stuff to protect his identity, because if some of the views he had, which are actually quite moderate, simply, you know, let's not have mass immigration into Germany, like, he could go to jail for some of those views. And I was talking to a guy the other day from Germany who said, you know, you are not legally allowed to differentiate between a ethnic German and a non-ethnic German in Germany. Like, you can go to jail for that. And that is scary as all hell. But that's the direction we're going in, you know?
Yeah. No, it's just insane. And what was the other thing I was going to bring up? Crap.
You forgot.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Was
it about censorship or was it about books? Because we're talking politics a little too much. I think George is going to get a little upset if she hears this one.
No, she won't. It's fine.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
It's not that bad.
But yeah, I mean, it does come back to books, but yeah.
No, it really does. And I'm trying to think of a way to, like, bring this on, but I just, I had, like, a great...
don't you hate that?
Yeah, no, it was like a great, like, you know, tie-in a little bit. It was like a little bit of a tie-in. And it
was, kinda... was it an anecdote?
No.
Okay.
Not really.
I'm sorry if I caused you to forget it with my rambling.
No, I don't, yeah. I'm
all right, really. you want to just bring this one home?
Yeah, we definitely covered.
We beat this to death, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we could bring it back to books for a few seconds and then just bring it home.
Okay, yeah. So let me just say that, you know, we've kind of expressed a lot of views here, some of the views political, some of the views literary. We ultimately are talking about this not to endorse a particular view or to say vote this way or think this way. We are simply saying that you as a writer and you as a reader as well are going to encounter things that you don't necessarily agree with, and that's okay. It's okay to encounter things that are dangerous. It's okay to encounter dangerous ideas. It is okay to talk about things that, you know, are not necessarily within the Overton window. It's okay to talk about things that are maybe, you know, a little bit out there, or maybe even a lot out there. And that is something that we want to encourage in writing, because really the best writing, to me, is writing that kind of not only embodies a time and a place, but that also embodies an idea, and those ideas need to be challenging ideas, and those ideas need to challenge the status quo. And today, to me, that means politically something that maybe it didn't mean 20 years ago, because the novels that are winning Hugo Awards today are not the same novels that, you know, Heinlein was writing, or Asimov was writing. the world has changed. We are a different kind of a place. And I want us to understand that as writers, it's okay to have or to explore thoughts that are not necessarily things you agree with. And you don't have to believe everything that you write. And you don't have to worry that if you write something that is maybe a little bit controversial, that you are going to, be responsible for the next school shooting. That is absolutely ridiculous.
No, I think writing and fiction specifically needs to be a place where it's okay to explore those types of ideas. And yeah. It's not a place where it's, you're encouraging a certain school of thought. I mean, and you could even premise it, say, hey, I just want to explore this.
But I wouldn't even put a qualifier on it. I wouldn't even put a qualifier on it and say, it's okay, I wanted to explore this, because I don't believe I have to justify myself to a reader. If a reader likes it, great. If a reader doesn't like it, whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is, did you have anything else you want to add?
No, that was it.
Yeah.
Fiction needs to be a place where unconventional thought, unconventional ideas, and conventional ideas, but, challenging ideas needs to be okay to express in fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is one of the things that I'm really proud about being associated with Uprising Review 4 is that we are addressing stories that are both good and challenging. And that's something we want to encourage from you, our readers or our listeners. We want you to send us your stories, send us your controversial stories, send us your dangerous stories, send us your dangerous ideas. You can send those to us at submissions@uprisingreview.com. If you have questions, comments, concerns about the podcast, it is podcast@uprisingreview.com. We want you to check out our website. We have new stories every Monday. We have podcasts on Thursday, Link Roundup on Friday, other good stuff. Follow us on Gab. Follow us on Twitter. You'll find the links on our website. We're pretty active on social media. If you enjoyed this, tell a friend. If you're a writer, tell a writer friend. If you're a reader, tell a reader friend. If you're listening to us on iTunes, leave us a rating. Leave us a thumbs up or a stars or whatever they have on iTunes. Because we really appreciate it. It goes a long way for us. And we want to thank you for joining us and for Uprising Review. For Steven, I am Everett. Thank you for listening.